Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin today with those diplomatic efforts to end the conflict between Israel and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Efforts led by the United States and France, but with the backing of other European countries as well as two Gulf Arab states. The proposal is for a three-week ceasefire to allow negotiations to begin, as set out by President Biden in Washington on Wednesday.
We put out a statement for a 21-day ceasefire along the Israeli-Lebanese border. We're able to generate significant support from Europe as well as the Arab nations, supporting this war not widen.
However, there's little sign of support from one of the warring parties, Israel, today. The Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, before heading off to the UN General Assembly in New York, said he'd ordered the Israeli military to continue with, quote, full force, though added that he hadn't given his formal response yet to the proposal. His foreign minister said there'd be no ceasefire until victory over Hezbollah. And one of their far-right cabinet colleagues, Bezalel Smotrich, rejected the idea of a truce out of hand. I've been talking to Boaz Bismuth, a member of parliament for Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party. Can he offer any clarity on the status of the ceasefire proposal?
In this war, I mean, Israel has objectives, of course. Let's start with the south. Just in the south, how to bring back all the hostages, of course, making sure that Hamas is not running Gaza anymore. And of course, I mean, bringing back again the quietness and peacefulness to the citizens of the south of Israel. Now, concerning the north, as you know perfectly well, after the massacre of the 7th on the 8th, Hezbollah decided that they want to join their brothers in the south. This was what they said. And ever since then, I mean, you know that we're attacked by missiles, by rockets. And the northern cities, places like Metula, like Kiryat Shmona, like Shlomi, I mean, the citizens don't live at home anymore for 11 months already. So as long as they cannot go back home because of Hezbollah, I don't think that the war is over.
Does that mean that Israel is rejecting this ceasefire proposal, as the foreign minister Israel Katz has said?
Well, it's very easy. I mean, I know what my Minister of Foreign Affairs has said, and I also heard the reaction of the Prime Minister, meaning there is no ceasefire. But you must understand, Israel is not keen on going to war. All of this war could be over by the end of the interview we're having right now, meaning if the hostages are back and Hamas, I mean, dismantles and goes out of Gaza, and same with Hezbollah, where they go where they should be, meaning northern of the Litani River, so there's no reason for a war. But as long as Hezbollah is not doing it, so why should Israel stop?
Does that mean then a ground offensive into southern Lebanon?
All of this war is defensive. We're the ones being attacked. We're the ones being aggressed. I mean, we're the ones being massacred ever since the 7th of October. So when you speak of an offensive, I have a problem. You can say, is Israel going to continue its defensive operation? I mean, the one
okay, well, let me put it another way. Would you support the presence of Israeli troops in southern Lebanon in the coming days?
I will support everything that will bring back quietness and peacefulness to the north of Israel. I would support everything that will bring back my auntie, who lives in Kiryat Shmona, back from the hotel in Jerusalem, where she lives for 11 months. I would support anything that is good for bringing tranquility, stability, and security to Israel. By the way, while you're interviewing me, I'm on my way to Yarka. It's a Druze village in the north of Israel. And I remember just a few weeks ago, me going to a funeral of 11 little kids killed by Hezbollah. So this is something that we will not allow and cannot happen again.
And yet, of course, as you well know, the damage in terms of lives and infrastructure in southern Lebanon has been far greater than the damage has been in Israel.
So, of course, and this is another reason why all of you, all the international community, should make sure that there is no terrorist entity, not in the south, of course, not in Gaza, and also in a sovereign country like Lebanon. I mean, is it logical that a group like Hezbollah, a terrorist organization, sits in the parliament or even in the government, making sure that Hezbollah cannot continue to operate, is not only good for us, it's also good for the Lebanese.
And the last time that Israel went into southern Lebanon, many Israeli soldiers died then too, and the country was left deeply traumatized by that war, which lasted just over a month. I mean, are you really prepared to go through that again?
So when you speak of the traumatized, on the contrary, I see an army, I see a population that is ready to go very far, but on one condition, that it will not be the same. It will never happen again. And in order to make sure it will never happen again, we have, in fact, to win this war. If we can obtain, I mean, all the needs for the security of Israel without war, of course, we'll do it. I mean, we're not keen to go to war.
Okay, so you're not closing the window completely on a possible ceasefire leading to further in-depth discussions about what happens in the months and years ahead in southern Lebanon.
Look, if I can obtain not only end of hostility, but end of capacity of a terrorist group to operate against me, I know only one thing, that I mean, what Hamas did on the 7th of October, Hezbollah would do exactly the same. We have a moral obligation towards our citizens, but you must understand, we're the ones here, we're attacked. We're not the aggressors, we are the army who defends its citizens.
Likud Party Member of Parliament Boaz Bismuth there. Well, let's hear from Northern Israel now, because as we heard, one of the aims of the war against Hezbollah is to allow the roughly 60,000 Israelis who've had to flee their homes close to the Lebanese border to return. They left as soon as the group started firing rockets over the border in response to the war in Gaza in October last year. And during that time, about 200 evacuees have been living in a hotel at Kibbutz Lavi, just west of the city of Tiberias. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams has been to see how they're getting on.
It's an incongruous scene, a dance party in a bomb shelter. After a year of life at Kibbutz Lavi, they're mixing play with safety, trying for a while not to think about what's going on outside. Rachel Rahamim is here with her husband and five children. They're from Kiryat Shmona, 30 miles north of here, right on the Lebanese border.
We thought it's safe here, that's why we came here, but all of a sudden, past 2 weeks, we are running back and forth to the shelter with the kids.
When you heard the sirens a few days ago, did you feel like the war was following you?
We felt the windows shaking. It was really scary. I got scared.
How are the kids?
They are scared too. They are afraid that there is going to be a siren in the middle of the night and we won't hear it. I will be confident to send my kids to go back to Kiryat Shmona when I can send my kids on the school bus without worrying to death.
Up the road in Kiryat Shmona, some buses are running, but there's no one on them. A city of 24,000 people is mostly deserted. Lebanon is just a couple of miles away, across the mountain that towers over the city. Kiryat Shmona is battle-scarred. Hundreds of buildings have been damaged by the rockets that arrive, usually with no more than a few seconds' notice, from across the border. This is a house that was hit here in Kiryat Shmona some months ago. And when you go inside, it is a complete wreck. The door frames are blackened and charred. We're here with Major Doron Spielman, a spokesman for the Israeli military. The army, he says, is determined to do whatever it takes to enable Israeli civilians to return to their homes.
So you're looking at over 100 homes in Kiryat Shmona look like this, where families, if they had lived here, would have been wiped out in an instant. This is what Israel is fighting for. Hezbollah is going to have to move back from the border of Israel. The only way these people are ever going to come back home is if Hezbollah is nowhere even close where they can shoot at them again.
As we prepare to leave Kiryat Shmona, the rockets start to fly once more, probably aimed at targets elsewhere, but intercepted right over the city. No damage this time, but a reminder that Hezbollah hasn't given up the fight.
We have a lot of shelters in the hotel, but that is not why the hotel is good. The hotel is good because of the atmosphere and the people.
Back at Kibbutz Lavi, the hotel manager, Moshe Gold, shows me how he and his staff are looking after their visitors from the border. He clearly cares deeply about them. Does he have time, I wonder, to think about what's happening on the other side?
We see the pictures at the TV. I'm not happy for what I see, that what happened to the civilians there. But now I have my own problems. We reached this point not because we started it or we want it. We've been dragged to this thing after what happened in the south. And I'm very sorry, but now I have to take care of my own people, my own responsibility.
Hotelier Moshe Gold ending that report by Paul Adams in northern Israel. Well, let's head across the border to the Lebanese capital, Beirut. There's been a strike in the southern suburbs of the city. The BBC's Lina Sinjab is in Beirut.
This is another Israeli-targeted airstrikes to Dahli area, which is in south of Beirut, a Hezbollah stronghold. However, it's an area condensed with civilians. There has been any confirmation yet on who is the target in this attack, but the Ministry of Health already confirmed at least three people were killed in this attack. And this is like really very close, in Beirut. People can see the smoke from their balcony and can hear the sound of explosions. Some areas can feel, the waves or that the explosion caused in this area. And Dahi is not, this is not the first time that has been targeted. There has been, several, targets in Dahi, several attacks in Dahi. And that's what people are afraid of here in Lebanon, that even Beirut, the capital, is not spared the price of the war and could expand beyond this neighborhood to further attacks in this area.
So no let up in Israel's bombardment. There have been more Hezbollah rockets fired across the border. Do we know what Hezbollah's position on this ceasefire proposal is?
There hasn't been any direct comment on the ceasefire itself, but Hezbollah has been, adamant that they will not stop firing rockets until there's a ceasefire in Gaza, actually, not here in Lebanon. There are some split views in Lebanon about this. Some people are wondering why wouldn't Hezbollah stop these firing rockets that are provoking reactions from the Israelis, but many others, the vast majorities, are shocked by the amount and the price that people, civilians, are paying because of the Israeli attacks inside Lebanon, in south of Lebanon specifically, and feel that it's disproportionate and indiscriminate targeting civilians.
Indeed, and we were hearing about Israelis who've had to leave their homes because of the fighting, but of course there are thousands of Lebanese who've had to leave their homes in the south of the country, aren't there?
Absolutely. That's been 3 days in a row where people are really fleeing, and that's in this round by itself. Some of them have been, displaced for 2-3 times since the start of this cross-border hostility, since the October 7th events last year. But now things are really going out of control. People feel that they are on the brink of a full-fledged war. Some people are arriving in Beirut. Some people are even leaving Beirut, going to the mountains. And many others are leaving the whole country.
That was our correspondent Lina Sinjab speaking to us from Beirut. More on this story coming up in about 15 minutes. You're listening to NewsHour. Also still to come, we'll hear about a new exhibition in London that brings together the French impressionist Monet's paintings of a smoggy River Thames.
Monet is a very early riser. He's up there with the dawn. Large brushes, visible brush strokes, importantly, many, many canvases, all of them on the go at the same time. He painted looking down. He wanted what he called the magnificent breadth. So he wants a panorama.
The report's coming up in 20 minutes. Let's just recap our main news this hour. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the military to continue striking Hezbollah with full force, despite international calls for a ceasefire. And the Sudanese army's launched a major offensive against the rival rapid support forces in the capital, Khartoum. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. President Biden's today announced he's releasing nearly $8 billion of aid for Ukraine. He's meeting with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, at the White House around about now. It comes just days after Mr. Zelensky announced his victory plan, as he called it, the details of which have so far remained secret, but which have been given added urgency by the uncertainty of November's US election. Whether it's all enough to defeat Russia remains to be seen. The BBC's Jessica Parker reports now from Ukraine's capital, Kyiv.
This White House meeting is probably the climax of a week of diplomacy for President Zelensky in the US. News that further American military aid is being sent to Ukraine will be welcomed here, as overnight, Russian missile and drone strikes continued, including here in Kyiv. This is the Pechersky district of Kyiv, and after last night's drone attack, here I can see blocks of flats with a lot of broken glass, broken windows, cars that have been pierced by shrapnel, and all across this little neighbourhood now, people are clearing up once again. 31-year-old Mariana is stood outside as they sweep the debris away, her two-month-old daughter strapped to her chest.
I woke up to the sound of the drone. I got up and saw the reflection in the windows, how a big ball of fire was falling down. A fragment flew into our window, wrecking the glass. Fortunately, miraculously, it didn't hurt the child who was sleeping there.
With President Zelensky presenting what he's calling a victory plan to leaders in the West, I ask Mariana how important Western support is to Ukraine's hope of fending off the Russian invasion.
I believe it's not possible we achieve that on our own. We need help from any countries, absolutely. Otherwise, we will not win.
I also ask 68-year-old Natalia if she believes victory is possible for Ukraine.
I don't know, but my close friend is fighting, and several more friends are fighting. Of course, they know better at the front, but they are not in the mood to surrender. They are fighting and not going to leave, run away from the front line or demobilize.
Despite the resilience of Ukrainians, there's a general recognition they need Western support, which depends not just on President Biden as he prepares to leave office, but also whoever comes next. A meeting between President Zelensky and Republican nominee Donald Trump, who's again hinted this week he could curtail support to Kyiv, now appears to be off, while some Republicans have criticized the Zelensky camp for what they see as partisan behavior, with just over a month to go before the US election.
Jessica Parker reporting there from Kyiv. Now, scientists in China say they've discovered the world's oldest known cheese from 3,500 years ago. They analysed dairy samples found with Bronze Age bodies that were buried in the Xinjiang region of Western China and found goat and fermenting microbes from kefir cheese. My colleague Fuchsia Dunlop's the author of many books on Chinese cuisine and its history, most recently Invitation to a Banquet, the Story of Chinese Food. Now, given that cheese isn't a staple of Chinese food, was she surprised by the discovery?
Well, not really. I mean, I think what this highlights is that Chinese cuisine has always been very multicultural and shaped not only by ancient indigenous traditions, but also by contact with people from, you know, in this period of time and the early dynasties, with people from the Northwest. So across North China, you still see the legacy of contact with all these nomadic peoples to the north and the west. And yeah, very interesting. I mean, still within Chinese borders, you have Uyghurs, Tibetans, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and they're all people who have dairying traditions and who eat various kinds of dairy food.
But not the prevalent culture. So what happened then?
Well, so for many parts of Chinese history, there were eras and there were areas where people did have a dairying tradition. So there's a very famous 6th century agricultural manual, which has a whole section on keeping cows and sheep and making things like yogurt. And during the Tang Dynasty, more than 1,000 years ago, the upper classes ate something like ghee, clarified butter and various kinds of yogurt and cheesy foods. But in the later dynasties, yes, it sort of became a very minority thing and largely died out by the end of the Qing dynasty. So in China today, there are pockets of very fascinating cheesemaking. So, for example, in Yunnan province in the southwest, The Yi people, that's one of the minority groups in this very diverse region, they make a goat's milk cheese, which is very like Indian paneer, a sort of simple fresh cheese. And another group in Dali in Yunnan province makes something a bit like mozzarella, where they're stretching the curds and then sun drying the cheese. So you have these little pockets of cheese making, but it never really caught on. I think what's really fascinating is that the Chinese didn't really need cheese because quite early on they started using the soybean, which is very protein rich and offers a similar sort of series of amino acids to those, you know, essential for human nutrition.
And can be fermented, and also to give, you know, that sort of richer flavour too, right?
They fermented soybeans to make things like the ancestors of soy sauce, fermented beans with these rich umami flavours. And then from at least 1,000 years ago, more than 1,000 years ago, they were making tofu. But the thing that's so interesting is that the technology of making tofu is terribly like the technology for making simple cheeses. You know, you have a milk, in this case a bean milk, and you coagulate it. You know, cheese is in Europe is mostly coagulated with rennet, an animal enzyme. But in China, they use gypsum mineral salts and things to coagulate the soybean. But you end up with something that looks quite cheese-like. So the Chinese perhaps didn't really need cheese in the same way.
Fuchsia Dunlop, my colleague and author of Invitation to a Banquet, the story of Chinese food on that discovery of the world's oldest known cheese, according to those Chinese scientists. Now, while all eyes have been on Lebanon, there are reports also today of an Israeli airstrike on a school sheltering displaced families in the northern Gaza Strip. Let's get a word from the BBC's Danielle De Simone, who joins us live from Jerusalem. Danielle, what more can you tell us?
So the details are coming out at the moment about this. We've got a report from the Israeli military itself and a report from the Palestinian, the Ministry of Health in Gaza, which is run by Hamas. The latter says this is a massacre and it's targeted displaced people at the Al-Fallujah school in northern Gaza. And they say so at least 11 people have been killed with at least 22 injuries, including women and children. The Israel Defense Forces said that they carried out what they call a precise strike on terrorists who are operating inside a command and control center embedded in what used to be the Al-Fallujah school in the northern Gaza Strip. And they say they took steps to mitigate the risk to harming civilians before doing that. This is the latest of a series of strikes against former schools. These buildings are typically used to house displaced people. According to the UN, almost the entire population of Gaza has been displaced. So most people there have been displaced from where they live. And Israel has carried out a series of airstrikes against former schools. And typically the statements say that they're operating as Hamas command and control centres. It's sometimes opaque about who is actually being targeted, and typically the statements from the authorities in Gaza will provide details about the numbers of people killed, typically broken down by gender and also by saying how many children have died. And today they are saying that women and children died. Just within the last week, we've had other strikes. Last Saturday, yeah. There were 22 people killed in an airstrike on a school in Gaza City.
Danielle, we'll have to leave it there. That was the BBC's Danielle De Simone joining us live there from Jerusalem. You're listening to NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour. A Japanese man who spent decades facing the death penalty has been acquitted in a retrial. Iwao Hakamada, who's 88 years old, is believed to be the world's longest-serving death row inmate. In 1968, he was convicted of murdering his boss, the man's wife, and their two children. The BBC's Shaima Khalil is in Tokyo.
The judge apologised to the sister of Iwao Hakamada, Hideko, his 91-year-old sister, who has long been attending these trials because of his ill health. The judge said, "I'm sorry for taking so long for the court to proceed." And this is precisely because it has taken decades for this legal saga to end. This is an acquittal for a man that has spent more time awaiting execution than anyone else in the world. And today, Iwao Hakamada was found innocent. And I think the one thing that this case has hinged on is whether the evidence had been fabricated. The lawyers, the defense lawyers, have been arguing that for years about the credibility of the evidence, essentially that the red stains found on clothes that were said to be worn by the killer, the alleged killer, could not have been blood, because blood would not remain that color red on clothing after it was immersed in miso for years. So the nature of the blood stains was the argument, and there was a lot of back and forth between the defense and the prosecution, who kept insisting on the death penalty for Mr. Hakamada. A key date, I would say, is 2014. He was released from jail, he was granted retrial, and then there was a lot of back and forth again between the High Court and the District Court, and it took until last year for the retrial to be re-granted, and then today for him to be announced innocent.
And after facing the death penalty for more than half a century, how is he now mentally?
He is not well at all. Supporters and rights advocates have for years criticized the way that he's been treated. Remember, he has been in solitary confinement, awaiting execution day in and day out for nearly half a century before he was released in 2014. And those who are close to him have said that it really impaired him and really deeply affected his mental health. His sister today, Hideko, was quite emotional in court. She was smiling outside court. But of course, the question here is how aware he is of what's happening. Since he was released, he was under her care, under her supervision, because of his ill health and because of his mental health. And I think a wider story here, and something that has been raised by rights advocates, is not only how long it lasted, but the nature of how he was treated. And of course, the fact that Japan, only Japan and the United States, are the two countries in the G7 in the G7 states that still adopt the capital punishment.
BBC Shaima Khalil in Tokyo, talking there to my colleague Valerie Sanderson. This is the BBC in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. Well, let's return to our top story. Those calls by the US, France and others for a three-week ceasefire in the conflict between Israel and the Lebanese militia group Hezbollah. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, now on his way to the UN General Assembly in New York, said he hadn't responded to the proposal, but had told the Israeli military to continue fighting. He's expected to meet the US Secretary of State later today. The latest Israeli strikes on Lebanon have killed at least 13 people, according to the government there, with more than 550 killed since Monday. Large numbers have fled southern Lebanon, where the strikes are concentrated, for makeshift shelters in the capital, Beirut. Etty Higgins is from the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF.
Many of the shelters are already full. As of last night, there was more than 50,000 people who are now housed in these shelters, and more on the streets because they had been unable to find shelter. So we're desperately trying now and working under extremely difficult conditions to support these thousands of displaced, mainly women and children.
On Wednesday, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council that hell was breaking loose in Lebanon and echoed the calls for the fighting to stop.
Civilians must be protected. The safety and security of all UN personnel and assets must be ensured. International law must be respected. To all sides, let us say in one clear voice, stop the killing and destruction, turn down the rhetoric and threats, step back from the brink.
Well, Matthew Levitt is director of the Counterterrorism and Intelligence Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I asked him how optimistic he was about the prospects for a ceasefire in Lebanon.
Cautiously optimistic, if I allow myself to be. Look, there's been a diplomatic effort that's been going on, not for weeks, but for months, led by U.S. diplomat Amos Hochstein, and Hezbollah has been uninterested. The painful reality is that the Israeli intensification over the past week is what makes Hezbollah suddenly interested. The Israelis have not said no to this, as you just quoted, but they've made it clear that they're going to continue fighting until there is a ceasefire. I think there are a couple of reasons for my cautious optimism. One is, forget the political...
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Crisis in Lebanon. The economic crisis in Lebanon is so severe that, unlike in 2006, the last time there was a war between Israel and Hezbollah, this time most Lebanese are not clapping for Hezbollah. Nobody in Lebanon wants this war but the most hardline Hezbollah people. And counter to conventional wisdom, perhaps, even the Iranians don't want full-fledged war right now because they want the powder dry on Hezbollah's weapons arsenal, some 150,000 rockets, because they see those as the best deterrent against an Israeli or any other strike against their nuclear program, a nuclear program that they've ratcheted up over the past 11 months. And so there's no guarantee. Lots of people making decisions and poor decisions in the middle and the midst of war. The Israelis after 11 and a half months of shelling. But I think there are some reasons to think maybe there could be this 21-day ceasefire.
On the other side, does the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu have the political capital, I mean, within his own government, to deliver a ceasefire, given that we've heard that some of his cabinet are vehemently opposed to it?
That's true, especially on the far right. There are people who are vehemently opposed to it. But more than that, there's general consensus, not 100%, but general consensus across the political Israeli spectrum among the public in support of Israel, from their perspective, finally striking back after almost a year of near daily strikes on the north. You have over 60,000 Israeli civilians displaced from their homes. But if there is a process that can get those people back to their homes comfortably and safely, I think that the majority of Israelis will support it and that will bring the majority of Israeli policymakers around.
I mean, Hezbollah has said that it'll stop if Israel ends its offensive in Gaza. I mean, the two things are inextricably linked, are they? And are those diplomats from the US, France and others, I mean, are they formulating their proposals on that basis? In other words, some sort of grand bargain to try and achieve a ceasefire both in Lebanon and in Gaza?
So these two fronts are linked only because Hezbollah has made them linked. I think it's important to remember that this is a war of choice for Hezbollah. Hezbollah started firing on Israel on October 8th, the day after the October 7th massacre. This was well before the Israel Defense Forces went into Gaza at all. And then subsequently, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, announced, as you said, that Hezbollah would continue firing until there was a ceasefire. That puts a whole lot of leverage in the hands of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza. And my conversations with officials here in Washington, whereas Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu was being not entirely compliant on ceasefire talks in terms of wanting to maintain control of the Philadelphia corridor, that border between Gaza and Egypt, that's largely been resolved, I understand. And the main impediment to a ceasefire in Gaza, which you're correct, could lead to Hezbollah stopping to fire in the north, the main impediment in the south is that Hamas has moved the goalposts and is demanding that more Hamas prisoners, more Hamas terrorists, more senior people with more blood on their hands be released in the first round, as opposed to in the second or third round, probably because they anticipate there won't be subsequent rounds of the ceasefire in Gaza. And that's what's delayed that. Absent that, we see what's happening in the north. So there's two ways to negotiate what's happening now. And I think officials, U.S., French, and others are trying both. One is an immediate 21-day ceasefire to get the fighting that's going on in the north to stop. The second is to extend that and to make some type of a grand bargain. And I think there's some hope that even Iran might push Hamas to accept some type of bargain, because at the end of the day, Iran doesn't want to lose Hamas as a fighting force, as it basically has in Gaza, and even more so lose Hezbollah in the north. Hezbollah is much more important to Iran than Hamas ever was.
So many moving parts. Just briefly, in terms of a longer term solution for what happens in southern Lebanon, I mean, we sort of know what the outlines of that look like, and it's some sort of buffer zone that's enforced, but it's not quite clear how, right?
Absolutely. We've been through this once before after the 2006 war. UN Security Council Resolution 1701 said that Hezbollah should be deployed north of the Latani River, which is not something that happened, that they should disarm and nobody should be providing them arms. In fact, they rearmed many times over. The UNIFIL, the UN force in the south, does what it does, but it's not very much. And so there's not a whole good amount of precedent for how to enforce that. And that feeds into the Israeli insecurities about any deal and whether it will be worth the paper it's written on.
And that was Matthew Levitt of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Now, most tourists hope for sun and blue skies visiting England, not always in vain, but not so the impressionist painter Claude Monet when he came at the turn of the 20th century. He wanted to capture the city's grandeur through the smog engulfing London at the time. The resulting series of paintings were exhibited in Paris and cemented his reputation as France's leading artist. Well, now London's Courtauld Gallery is recreating that exhibition with many of the paintings reunited for the first time, a wish of Monet's that was never realised in his lifetime. Nicola Stanbridge reports.
About 125 years ago, Claude Monet arrives here at the Savoy for several months to paint nearly 100 canvases of the Thames looking up and downstream through a heavily industrialised, sooty, smoggy, atmospheric London landscape. He was fascinated by what he called the delicious fog. He told a journalist that London's more interesting, that it's harder to paint. The fog assumes all sorts of colours, black, brown, yellow, green, purple fogs, and the interest in painting is to get the objects as seen through all these fogs. Jackie Wulschlager, author of Monet, The Restless Vision. How did Claude Monet choose his view of London?
Well, Monet arrived in 1899 after quite a traumatic period in France, and he wanted something absolutely new and different. The Savoy was the latest word in modern hotels. The bridges that he saw, I see as his bridge to the 20th century. There was Charing Cross Bridge, the horizontal, modern, gleaming, metallic rail bridge on one side, and on the other, the much older Waterloo Bridge with its cavernous arches.
Let's go and see his choice of view. So here we are in one of the suites, bedroom to our left, and a living room to our right. But the living room he would have used to store all his canvases.
Oh, to paint in. He made the sort of studio he had at home. And there he stood at the window, waiting for the changing light effects.
He also wants to be outside painting. He's on a balcony here. Describe his actual process.
Monet is a very early riser. He's up there with the dawn. Large brushes, visible brush strokes. Importantly, many, many canvases, all of them on the go at the same time. He painted looking down. He wanted what he called the magnificent breadth. So he wants a panorama. Vehicles going across Waterloo Bridge, which was not the bridge we see now. It was the old 1817 bridge. So he had the cavernous arches and their reflections set against the South Bank with all its chimneys and industrial stacks. The industrial smog and the steam. He wanted the excitement of being able to sort of see through it and sort of not. And that's really what we get and why they are so mysterious. He crosses a river, he goes to paint the Houses of Parliament, painting from the top of the roof of St. Thomas's Hospital. And there he's painting really sort of day becoming night, that moment of velvety darkness descending.
In all weathers?
Oh, he never thought twice about his safety like that. And of course, what do you know? He did end up with pneumonia. And he was stuck in the Savoy for 3 weeks, unable to move. His appetite was legendary, so that didn't stop.
Is that the first time you've seen that view?
It's the first time I've had the pleasure of being up there exactly as Monet was, and I think it's remarkable to see what he saw and then see what he did with it.
So 37 out of his 100 paintings would go on to a show in Paris in 1904, and we're going to go and look at 18 that are being brought together here in London. His intention was for them to be shown in London, so why has it only happened now?
It didn't work with his dealer, and Monet was disappointed. But it's a very exciting moment, and the fact that this show is taking place in the Courtauld, which is so close, it is very magical. You're walking into a man's vision of London on all sides. The London Paintings was the first really immersive show. If we look at these incredible Houses of Parliament, we see how he's playing with colour and he's playing with light, and he knows he can do anything, and that's why it is so fantastic to see them all together, because it is like a symphony orchestra. Each one contributes its bit. And Monet was criticised for the first 20 years of his career. People said, it's slapdash, you're just painting an impression, what use is that? And when he puts the impressions together, suddenly it is understood.
That was Nicholas Stanbridge reporting on that new exhibition of Monet's Paintings of London. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Next month, we'll see commemorations across Israel, marking a year since the October the 7th attacks. More than 1,200 people died, and well over 200 others were taken hostage when Hamas gunmen crossed the border from Gaza, killing indiscriminately. They attacked many dozens of sites, including kibbutzim communities, army bases, and the Nova Music Festival. Hundreds of people were murdered, while others were tortured and raped. BBC Storyville has been speaking to some of those who survived. Some of the material was recorded by them, some of it by Hamas. And as you can imagine, it is all distressing. I've been talking to the documentary's director, Yariv Moser, and one of the survivors at the festival, Ben Sadeh.
Very closely to what happened on the 7th of October, there were already denials and conspiracies on social networks. I was there on the site of the Nova massacre. I saw it in my own eyes. I was determined that this truth about what happened should be out there as a piece of history.
Did you feel also that it was a year on in danger of being forgotten to some extent, especially given all that has happened in the nearly 12 months since?
Oh, definitely. I think the world moved on. And of course, the war is still going on, unfortunately. The price is high on both sides, but people need to remember where it all began.
And what is extraordinary and particularly harrowing, of course, is that much of the footage that you use is from that time. It's mobile phone footage. I mean, how did you gather all that up?
So amazingly, those survivors had the feeling that the necessity to use their own cell phone and capture the moments. At the same time, I was keen to have the footage that was captured by the perpetrators themselves, the terrorists. They each had a GoPro camera and they were documenting the atrocities.
Let me bring in Ben, who's come in today too. And you were filming on that day. Can you remember why you decided to switch on your phone camera?
I remember that this is my first video. This I'm running on my life. And just I realized that something like this never happened to us. I live in the South. I know what is like they send rocket to us and I need to go the fast as I can to the shelter. But something like this with a lot of terrorists, in this moment I realized this is something that never happened. And these videos and these photos, it's going to worth a lot. One video, I was down the tree, and this moment I realized that, yeah, there is possible that I'm going to die, and this is going to be my last video.
Was it hard participating in the documentary, reliving what happened? I mean, it must have been very traumatic.
Look, everybody in this case is very traumatic about all the situation. It's not obvious to speak about it here, not obvious to speak on TV and the news. It's really hard because I tell this so much time and it's hard, but I try to do my best all the time because I know this is very important to speak about it and put it out to me and to the world that don't really understand what we've been through.
How did you manage to survive? It was you and another woman. You were essentially hiding together, weren't you?
It was very quiet, a few minutes, that like complete with the dead. I just said to myself, it's not gonna be like this. I'm not gonna stay here. I'm not gonna die. I'm gonna continue, and she come with me, however what it takes. Yeah, remember she told me, you please don't grab me anymore. I cannot move anymore. My foot is bleeding. But I told her, it's not going to happen. You with me, and doesn't matter whatever it takes, you with me, and you're going to see your kid, and you're going to see your husband, and doesn't matter, I'm going to grab you on my back, and we're running, and walking, and hiding, and 16 kilometers that I thought is not gonna over.
16 kilometers?
16 kilometers in the sun.
Yariv, you must have been aware when you were making the film of your responsibility to those taking part in it and giving their testimony. How did you deal with that?
We took some time. We didn't open the cameras just after the attack. We did some research. I met a lot of survivors and decided who is capable enough, mentally capable, to sit in front of the camera and bravely talk about what happened to him. I had a psychologist on the set with me to accompany the survivors and talk with them after the interview to see that everyone are okay.
And Ben, you talked about telling the story, retelling the story. I mean, has that process of telling the story over and over again, I mean, does that help you process what happened?
Absolutely right. I realized to get out from this trauma is to talk about it, to let it out with family, with your friends, not keep it in your heart. I remember a lot of my friends that in this moment after the festival didn't talk with anybody. And this is like a conflict between you and yourself, and no one know what you've been through.
And is it difficult, this is a difficult question, but is it difficult trying to process the fact that you survived and others didn't?
Yeah, Yariv, how would you call it?
Survivor's guilt.
Yeah, survivor guilt. And when you think about it, yeah, it's hard. It's hard, like, why me? Why not him? He's more good than me. You have a lot of questions and hard questions because you're in this life, you're alive, and they not. We realize the life is worth a lot.
Yariv, I think you said that it's not a political film, but it was a national trauma, wasn't it, for Israel?
Oh, of course. I think that the film is critical towards the Israeli government as well. It is hard for Israelis to watch it. We are still seeking answers from our government. For one thing, I think the film strongly is saying Hamas is a terror group that I differentiate from the Palestinian people. I really hope for reconciliation, for peace between the two nations, but this is not what Hamas is seeking.
To end, hopefully on a more optimistic note, I mean, the film is called We Will Dance Again. What optimism, what hope can you find, Ben?
Party is one of the best things that I do in my life. I'm a DJ and producer, and this is my life music. And it's so hard to right now go to the party and just think about people that not here. It's hard. But I see the people that not with me, and I'm dancing for them.
Ben Sadeh and director Yariv Moser. The full documentary Storyville, Will We Dance Again, is available from today on the BBC iPlayer if you have access, and other platforms. And it is part of a group of programmes marking a year since those October the 7th attacks. Another documentary from the BBC, Life and Death in Gaza, will be broadcast in October. That is it for this edition of the programme. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next time. Bye-bye.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm.
There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.